specific to San Francisco and to our experience. So any forceful opinions are entirely my own. But, you know, my immediate predecessors were Gail Bolin and Jeff Klausner, no shrinking violets, either one of them. So I think it's one of the requirements of the job to speak up. So I'm going to be talking about the challenge of cephalosporin-resistant GC that we faced in San Francisco. And as an outline, I'm going to just give a little bit of background, not too much. I think it's great that we've had such a distinguished panel to really lay the groundwork, so I'm going to dive right into what we've experienced and what the program issues are, what we've done for assessment, and then strategic communication and education efforts, and where the real needs are. So I was happy to be asked to give this talk, and I thank the organizers. One of the reasons I was happy is that it enabled me to find this article online. And this is from a blog in San Francisco, but it's the San Francisco Chronicle. And it came out last year in the summer, right after the MMWR article by Bob and colleagues from CDC came out. And they wanted to interview me about this idea of resistant GC. But the really interesting thing about this is that on the print version of the paper, there was this 26-foot statue of Marilyn Monroe in Chicago. And she's from this is a scene from her famous movie, The 7-Year Itch. And so that was transposed right next to the gonorrhea article, which was really clever, I thought. So in San Francisco, gonorrhea, you see the trend from 1955 to 2011. We had just over 2,200 cases in 2011, so much less than our height of over 18,000 cases in 1979, but still one of the pressing issues and pressing concerns for us today in the STD section. And if you look at who's reporting gonorrhea to us in San Francisco, over half are either from City Clinic, which is our municipal STD clinic, or Magnet, which is the Gay Men's Health Center in the Castro. So over half the gonorrhea reported to us are from either of those two sites, which is helpful to us in STD control as we operate one of those sites, City Clinic, and we work very closely with Magnet. For our protocols in San Francisco, as of January of 2011, we're following CDC guidelines. So the treatment there is ceftriaxone, 250 milligrams, and azithromycin, 1 gram, as you know. Prior to that, we didn't use cefixime. We used cefpidoxime, 400 milligrams. We still do expedited partner therapy in San Francisco, and our partner packs are cefixime, 400 milligrams, PO, and azithromycin, 1 gram. And we do not have any routine interviews or contact tracing that we do for GC. Okay, so identifying patients with gonorrhea with decreased antimicrobial susceptibility in SF, what have we been doing? So following up our STD clinic patients who are at risk for treatment failure is a priority, and the goals, as many of you understand, are to ensure GC treatment failures are not missed as one, identify risk factors for acquiring cephalosporin-resistant GC is an important goal, and slowing the spread of cephalosporin resistance. If that is indeed possible, that's what we'd like to try to do. And our protocol has really evolved over time, so I want to kind of walk through the different steps that it's taken. In December of 2009, the initial protocol was implemented along with Mark's lab. So I'm leaving out a lot of the background, but the work that started in 2009 was based on the work that he presented looking at SFA and SFB as the mosaic alleles. So the protocol was implemented for the follow-up of those identified cases. And it included patients with a mosaic PCR positive for GC at any anatomic site when we started. And as I said before, cefpidoxime was our first-line treatment at the time. So you saw the scientific side of the results that came out of the lab. And so I want to just tell you the epi that we found in following up on these cases. So 94% of those with either a mosaic positive or a GISP alert were MSM. There were a total of 33 that occurred between December 2009 and December 2010. 24% were HIV positive. We couldn't find 47% of those patients, and it was very difficult to try and locate them, much more so than for our syphilis cases during the same time period. 25 of them had a repeat Aptima Combo 2 done, which is our test in the STD clinic that we use, and 92% of those were negative. Two of them had a positive repeat AC2. One was later, at 7 months later, was negative. And then there was one possible treatment failure, but it's very unclear because he had a lot of interim sex partners. It was unconfirmed, and he resolved with ceftriaxone 250 milligrams. So we can't say that there was a definitive treatment failure. From December 2010, we had to halt the PCR testing of all the NAT specimens at the lab because it was quite a bit of work to try and process all those specimens. And the follow-up was instead limited to the GIST specimens, the urethral specimens. And the protocol was modified to encompass the California GIST project that Mark was describing. In January of 2011, the e-test system with GIST was started, California GIST. Ceftriaxone was implemented in San Francisco as first-line treatment, and we really tried to emphasize partner elicitation and treatment more than we had prior. So let's think a little bit about GISP. So City Clinic has been a GISP site since its initiation in 1987. The limitations are the ones that you'll hear many times at this conference. It's an SCD clinic population. It's only urethral cultures and so on. And one limitation that we experienced in San Francisco was that there previously were very extensive delays in getting those results back, sometimes up to 6 months. And we've been very happy with Dr. Shoje's work in being able to get us those specimens within about 5 weeks. So that limitation has really, really gone away. Thinking about California GISP, these are, as Mark said, GISP isolates from San Francisco, San Diego, LA, and Orange County, all tested at the public health lab. Looking at antimicrobial susceptibility testing to azithromycin, cefixime, and ceftriaxone. And the e-test results are available to us within 2 weeks. And Mark will actually send out the reports to us as the sites on about an every two-week basis, showing us if there are any alert values from the prior sample that were sent. Highly comparable to agar dilution, 85% in our experience are identical to less than one dilution difference, and 98% within less than two dilutions. And this allows for a much faster follow-up of alert values, as you can imagine, getting the reports every 2 weeks. But it is subject to the same limitations as overall GISP. So here are our results from 2011. There were 27 alert values in 18 visits, and that was either for e-test or GISP. Some patients had multiple alert values. There was one individual who actually had three alert values. 18 of those were both e-test and GISP, so the majority. 7 were GISP but not e-test reactive, and 2 were alerts on e-test but not on GISP. And the alerts were for the antimicrobials that you see below. The majority were for cefpodoxime. The characteristics of the folks in 2011 in the California GISP project were 14% were MSM, and 3 were HIV infected. And now, again, I'm speaking of the San Francisco results here. Mark showed you the results for the entire project. 11 of those individuals had a follow-up Aptima Combo 2 sometime following the alert value, and one of the 11 was positive with a repeat urine AC2, but the culture was negative. 56% of the patients were assigned for an interview, and that occurred because there were some issues in setting up the system initially, and there were some miscommunications and some problems in getting the system fully automated so that it would work and flow. So there was an error that happened with that. But 8 patients of those 10 could be reached, but only 2 partners were named, and neither returned for testing. So we haven't had really great ability to follow up on the cases that we have identified. So the challenges in following up, I mentioned before that the system needed a lot of tweaking to be able to set up and to now maintain. It was a very intermittent task that was being assigned. There were only 18 in all of last year. And so relative to other follow-up tasks, it made it much more difficult to remember to do it and to routinely actually do the follow-up. There was more test interpretation that was required as well. And it wasn't initially automated like our other case-finding work, and I think that was the main difficulty. It was sort of sitting outside of our usual systems, and now it's been much more incorporated. And then, as I mentioned, very few partners were elicited, and we weren't able to bring any of them, either of them, back. And that is, again, a huge challenge for being able to tie the clinical data and epi data back to the lab. So the protocol continues to evolve, and as of September of last year, 2011, because of the poor follow-up success and multiple contributing factors, we've made some changes. So there's now a single person who's working all cases, so he's much more familiar with the questioning and the protocols that are needed. And the system is now more automated and into our electronic system, and there are clearer feedback mechanisms that also occur to ensure that cases are assigned and followed up as needed. So messages to public and providers. So what do we tell people? Our knowledge is still growing, is somewhat limited at this time, but people are still asking questions, as you saw with that article where I was asked to comment. So one of the key things that we found in San Francisco is to really make ourselves readily available to media. Our public information officer knows to contact me if she gets any requests about GC or STDs in particular. Our website continues to be a resource for providers and community members, and that is one of the key places in which we disseminate information and have it available for future reference, and I'll show you some examples of how that works. We have community partners groups. We have two, one, both of which are focused on our priority populations in San Francisco. We have one that deals with adolescents in southeast neighborhoods of San Francisco that are disproportionately affected by GC and chlamydia. We also have an MSM community partners group as well. And those partners groups are key components to our response and to our messaging. We do an STD update course. We hadn't done one since 2008, but we did our most recent one in 2011. And that is, again, a way to really inform providers about the need for careful monitoring for treatment failures and for using dual therapy. And then our staff reviews all the confidential morbidity reports that are the reports that providers in San Francisco are required to send to us of their GC cases. And often, if there is initially a provider who is not treating appropriately with dual therapy, that triggers a follow-up call, initially by our staff who do surveillance and monitoring. And then if that doesn't work, then Dr. Stephanie Cohen, the medical director, or I will try and follow up to explain the need for ongoing adherence to treatment. And then repeating all of these things multiple times. So here's an example of how we do messaging to providers and community. We generate a monthly STD report, and it's available on our website, as you see there. So we have the data for the month above, but down below, I think the most important piece of this report is that we always put in a little editorial. And for example, here we, after the MMWR last summer, we did an update on GC with decreased susceptibility. And this way, we're able to sort of put the key points that we want providers to think about in an easy-to-read and succinct message. We also, on our website, have a whole section that's for providers, and underneath there is treatment FAQs for gonorrhea. We anticipated what a lot of the questions would be about why dual therapy, what if I treat with azithromycin 4 days later, and all of those kinds of things, and we put that into one document, and that's available for reference for providers, and we refer people to that quite as much as well. And then the STD update that occurred in October, this year for the first time, we've actually archived the presentations, and they're, again, available on the website. So it's another way in which we try to reach out to make sure that folks are following the treatment guidelines. But what are the remaining questions? We talked a lot about what our section has done in response to the issue of GC, and I really want to emphasize that the collaboration that we've been able to have with Dr. Pandori and his lab has been really to our benefit, and really have gained a lot in terms of our program capacity in working with Mark, and also just in terms of our professional growth and expertise in areas in which we are not closely familiar. So what about rapid molecular methods to assess susceptibility? We've heard several times during the meeting that culture capacity is limited. But what I would argue, and here's where I'm starting to put my pushy San Francisco hat on, is that that horse is out of the barn. That is unlikely to return. And we may call, and CDC may call for an increase in culture, but in my mind, that is best served in select centers, public health labs, maybe certain other regional laboratories. We are not going to get providers to go back to culture, and maybe, you know, neither should they. We've really pushed NATs appropriately. They are better tests for detecting infection. We want to make sure those people get detected and get screened and treated appropriately. And so figuring out how to marry these two needs, the need for the ability to detect antimicrobial susceptibility and also to have the best tests available for patients and communities, those have to come together. And that has to be a research priority to see how we could do both of those things. What about this other question, when to retest for test of cure? So there have been messages that have come out from our state STD branch as well as from CDC advocating test of cure. But really, when I talk to providers, I can't tell them exactly why it is that we are telling them to do this in 1 week. And is that really the correct data? And again, all these remaining questions that I'm focusing on are key to our ability as a program to inform providers and inform community and actually know what we're talking about and get these messages out. So in Los Angeles, there is a project pilot that Dr. Sarah Gary and others are doing from vaginal swabs. And that's happening with Dr. Pandori and his team in San Francisco. And in San Francisco, we've really thought hard about this, and Kyle Bernstein has written up a study protocol among MSM looking at rectal, pharyngeal, and urine specimens as well, but it's not currently funded, and so we're waiting to see if we're going to be able to do that. And through the STD Surveillance Network, SUN, there is a project that assesses timing and results of repeat tests, but the challenge with these projects is that you really need intensive resources in order to have folks test daily and have the specimens available for testing. So it's going to require intensive resources and intensive cooperation with centers to be able to do this, recruit patients, retain them, and do the testing. What about other alternative treatment? I think Dr. Warkowski yesterday gave a great summary of where we are to date. But the thing that's furthest down the pipeline and is already in progress is the STI-CTG dual treatment study, which has been referred to during this meeting several times as well. So that's looking at a randomized trial, gentamicin and azithromycin for uncomplicated urogenital GC, or gemifloxacin and azithromycin. In San Francisco, City Clinic right now is one of four clinical sites that's working on this project, and we're doing that again in partnership with the Public Health Lab and Dr. Pandori's team. And participation in this study has consumed much of the GC culture capacity at the lab because it's quite intensive to do cultures from the pharynx and the rectum to select out the Neisseria gonorrhea isolates. And the study, through no fault of the study chairs or any of the sites, has taken a long time to actually accrue enough participants. And so initially when we thought that the study would be ending at the end of last year, it's now pushed out further. And so, you know, there are other projects that we would like to be doing to assess some of these other questions that then have to wait. So again, looking at resources and other sites and other places that might be able to be doing this work becomes very important. And then susceptibility testing at non-genital sites. I think Mark's presentation and Dr. Trees really summed up what the difficulties are, and particularly in the pharynx. But still, projects of great interest to us are to submit rectal and pharyngeal cultures to this California GS project for e-test. So LA has started doing that, so that's some of the preliminary data that Dr. Pandori was talking about, and it's planned that we should do this in San Francisco. But again, this is going to further tax the culture capacity at the lab, both with staffing and actual physical space. It's located in a building that's quite old, and there's really no expansion ability there. And then the CDC's extragenital gonococcal surveillance, or EGGS, that start has been delayed in San Francisco due to the current GC lab projects. But again, it should be a priority and should be done. So what are the next steps? There are many actions that local programs can take now, as you've seen, that we've tried to do in San Francisco. Assessing and strengthening the current surveillance capacity with lab partners in close conjunction is critical, is so important. And then developing and using consistent messages in a variety of formats, both to providers and to community, is also important. And that's difficult because, I've heard several people, questioners and commenters say, we don't know exactly what it is we're supposed to be telling people. Are the barbarians at the gate? Is it overblown to really call this a superbug? So finding the right tone and being consistent is important, but it does require sort of some thoughtful planning around a strategic communication strategy. And CDC can add significant value with thoughtful coordination and funding. And I think that is where we as programs need to give feedback very clearly about what would be helpful to us on the ground to actually deal with the cases and deal with providers and answer the questions. So I thank them for the work that they've done to date. I look forward to our continued close working relationship together. And I'm glad that there's room for different levels of expertise, different levels of opinions about what to do, because the best way to handle this challenge is going to be having thoughtful people working together to try and solve the issues. So thank you very much. And I do want to thank, just finally, all the people that I work with in San Francisco, both in our SPD section and in the public health lab. It's really a pleasure to work with all of them. Dr. Shoje from the University of Washington and Dr. Kirkcaldy from JISP as well.